You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 13th of July 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
Et moi je salue le courage.
I pay tribute to the courage, especially the political courage of a government which faced up to the difficulties, including the legitimate political debate and serious and difficult political debates, to put in place finally solid reforms which will allow Greece to get out of the situation it finds itself in.
France's finance minister attempts optimism as Greece and its creditors agree a deal to prevent the Eurozone's first escape. But is it worth the price either side will have to pay? Guests Mary Dejewski and Jeffrey Kaufman will discuss that and the day's other big stories, including Mexico's failure to keep its most notorious criminal behind bars, Islamic State's outreach to Russian recruits, and the undignified departure of Serbian Prime Minister Aleksandar Vučić from Srebrenica. But should he really have gone in the first place, especially as his country continues to split hairs over what happened there 20 years ago? That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the program. My guests today are Mary Dejewski, chief editorial writer and columnist at The Independent, and Jeffrey Kaufman, the journalist and commentator. Welcome both. We will start tonight, as we have so often in the past, with Greece, which it now appears will remain a member of the Eurozone. But at what cost? A third bailout has been agreed, allowing for 86 billion euros over the next 3 years, or roughly the GDP of fellow EU member Slovakia. Among other strictures, Greece will be obliged to raise its retirement age, liberalise its labour markets, actually collect taxes, and agree to various privatisations. Jeffrey, I'll ask you first of all, definitely more in hope than expectation. Is this actually a solution, or are we people professionally concerned with current affairs broadcasting doomed to carry on discussing this until the sun dies?
Oh, I think that's a very easy question. This is just keeping the debate going. Greece is far from solved. And I think Angela Merkel actually summed it up in a statement that she made. It's really not simply about saving the euro. She said the most important currency has already been lost, and that's trust. And I would add to that confidence. I think that the euro has been the euro that was designed to bring Europe together, that was really a political, using economics for political ends, has now been utterly undermined. It doesn't mean it can't recover 5-10 years from now, but no, this is far from over. We're going to be talking about Greece around this table for a long time. And listen, this is a human story. This is a story about massive political mess up. It's about economic malfeasance and incompetence, but it's also about a huge suffering on a human scale that just shouldn't have happened in Western Europe in the 21st century. There's the utter incompetence, not only the Greek government, but the other governments that are complicit in letting Greece into the Eurozone.
When
they knew full well back in the 90s that it really didn't qualify.
The good news here, I suppose, is that the Greek people will hopefully be tonight possibly slightly less terrified than they possibly have been over the last week or two. They at least know what currency they will be paid in for the foreseeable future, at least. Mary, though, we'll start with the big question here, though. Is this worth it? Is it worth this astonishing expense for both Greece's creditors, Greece's people, for how long, nobody knows, to keep 11 million people inside the single currency?
Well, I think when we're talking about confidence and trust in the euro as much as anything else, then we have to imagine how much worse it would have been if we'd been looking at Greece falling out of the euro. Now, there are plenty of people who will say, well, if Greece had fallen out of the euro, then the value of the euro would probably have risen colossally, practically overnight, because it would be felt that the euro had lost one passenger, a bankrupt passenger, albeit rather a small one in the context of the euro. But on the question of whether it's worth it, personally, I'm completely split about this, because on the one hand, I believe in the European project, and I think it's a good thing, and I think it would have been a catastrophe for Europe as a whole if the euro had died, as it was threatened with doing pretty much all over the last week. So on the one hand, that's what I think. On the other hand, I've been to the Baltic states, and I've watched as Latvia, which has a minute economy, okay, but it was boasting for a couple of years about how it had made itself solvent, even when it wasn't in the euro, that it had refused to devalue its currency, it had inflicted enormous losses and suffering on its population in order to keep up its exchange rate and qualify to enter the euro, which indeed it did. Now, I went back to Latvia 2-3 years later, and you look around you and you do ask the question, was it worth it? There are large numbers of unemployed. Now, this is a few years ago, so that may have improved. The quality of the infrastructure had been neglected. There were all sorts of temporary shops and very little overt investment. So, and there was a huge emigration of young, well-qualified people who saw a better future for themselves outside their country, including in the UK.
And those are the last people you want to lose when you're trying to establish or re-establish a country. A problem that Greece is likely to find itself facing as well. Jeffrey, it's worth remembering, of course, that this is not a done deal yet. Greece's Prime Minister still needs to get this past Greece's Parliament, which could be interesting for him. But the conditions that have been attached, to what extent do you think they are actually punishments? This is the EU making an example of Greece.
Let me just say, first of all, I was relieved to hear what Mary just said, because I agree. I sit on the fence on this. I can argue very persuasively both sides of whether Greece should have been kicked out or kept in. Ultimately, I think history will tell us whether this was right, but I think that they really kind of had to do this to keep them in. As to your question, the education of Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras in just a matter of months,
it is going to make
suddenly,
some book, isn't it?
Oh my gosh. You know, to watch him coming in, saying, I'm going to tell the world. You know, first of all, you know, his finance minister gets told, you know, we're not going to continue if you sit at the table. He resigns. This is talk about a humiliation. Talk about a step down. You know, he had a referendum a week ago that absolutely rejected what he's just accepted.
Actually, rejected possibly a better deal than what he's just accepted.
Exactly. And so, is it punishment? I'm afraid that for the average Greek person, the ones who not the ones who evade taxes and don't acknowledge their swimming pools, but the 95 or 98% of Greeks who are caught in this, it is punishment in a form. Perhaps not. Angela Merkel would say it's strong medicine. But the fact is, these people are really struggling. I mean, I was in Greece during these stories 2 years ago, and the stories we were getting from people who were grandmothers giving up their glaucoma medication so their grandchildren could get baby formula. I mean, this is just compounded now. And so, yeah, the suffering is going to continue. You know, it's all great that we can go to Santorini and all these, you know, as British tourists and North American tourists, but the suffering that's going to be seen in the coming years is really huge for the Greek people.
And I think the question is really not whether we see it as punishment for Greece, but whether the Greeks see it as punishment. And I think the jury is going to be out on that, because so far as I can judge just from today, the population, social media feedback is that they're incredibly split. And when you consider this in the framework of, say, what happened, although it's totally unrelated, in Ukraine, you say this is the stuff of what revolutions are made of. And there is no certainty in my mind that this time next week, this time in a month, we will actually see this deal sticking and we won't see masses of Greeks on the streets.
I would agree. And I think that one of the reasons this had to happen was that as much as you could, you know, you could put on your schoolmasters or schoolmistresses guys and say, you didn't behave properly, we're expelling you. The problem is, of course, that just sets up a wild card with Russia and others. And the last thing that Europe wants to see is Greece in anger turning to Russia or others to spite the Germans and the rest of Northern Europe. And so, you know, I think in that from that perspective, it really had to be done. I think that to try to keep Greece within the fold. But the other thing that has to be done, and this is where I'm much less confident, is that they need massive institutional change in Greece. I mean, the number of civil servants per capita is outrageous. The pensions, the entrenched benefits of citizenship for those who are privileged enough to achieve it at certain levels are just ridiculous compared to anything else in particularly in Northern Europe. And that needs to change. Of course, it's an entitlement, and it's very hard to give away entitlements.
But if you were Greek, would you not be saying, isn't there an alien model being imposed on us by Germany and by the North Europeans?
Sure, if you're a 75-year-old Greek pensioner being told that your pension's going to be cut in half, or if you're a 45-year-old bureaucrat who's really not had to go to the office to get your pension, to get your salary, and you're secure until you retire and get your pension. I mean, there are some great deals for the people who have benefited, but the gravy train has to stop. The problem is it requires tax collectors, it requires civil servants cuts, it requires pension cuts, and it's going to hurt a lot of people, some of whom deserve to be hurt, frankly, but many of whom don't.
Okay, well, we're going to move along now to Mexico, where we find a story straight out of the You Had One Job file. The you, in this case, being the wardens of Altiplano Prison outside Toluca, and the one job being keeping Mexico's most dangerous man confined to one of its cells. However, Joaquin Guzman, known as El Chapo, the billionaire head of the Sinaloa drugs cartel, escaped from the facility at the weekend via a mile-long tunnel. This story, disclaimer at the start, it's obviously not funny. But seriously, this tunnel was a mile long. It had lights and air conditioning. A motorcycle was found inside it. It suggested that El Chapo may actually have ridden along the tunnel on same vehicle. Mary, a possibly naive question. Do we assume that this may not have been a complete surprise to some members of the prison staff?
Well, I think we have to assume that, because it's very hard to believe that sort of a tunnel, indeed a tunnel at all, apparently out of the bathroom or the shower room of the prison.
Out of the shower block to a building site approximately a mile away.
Yes, that this could actually have been accomplished overnight. And if it couldn't be accomplished overnight, then somebody's going to know about it. And if it was that high and that wide, and it had stairs too, I gather, as well as the motorcycle, then it's very hard to believe that it was done without complicity.
The fixtures and fittings were possibly a necessity of how long it takes to dig a mile-long tunnel. I don't know how long that takes. It's almost like he was gloating. I mean, you'd be unsurprised to discover that, you know, he'd hung paintings on the walls.
But he wasn't in there practically long enough to dig that sort of a tunnel.
It is extraordinary, and obviously this is the mother of all bad news stories for President Nieto, who had accrued significant political capital from Guzman's original recapture last year. He had escaped previously in 2001, that time in a laundry basket. How damaging is this to Mexico's government, I guess, Jeffrey? I mean, to what extent it's not an insignificant story, but it's a story of one man. But does this something like this dent faith in the state?
Listen, it is not hyperbole to say that he is now the most wanted man in the world. He is the most dangerous man, a criminal in the world. This is a man who controls something like 25% of the world's drug trade. I mean, it is staggering, the scale of the Sinaloa cartel and what they will do for control. He is so wealthy that it's not at all surprising that these tunnels were built. And to be clear, he has built, he and the cartel have their fingerprints on about 100 tunnels under the U.S., California, the California and Arizona borders into Mexico, which were used for smuggling drugs. He has a network of expert tunnel builders. It's not at all hard to see what he's done. But yes, President Nieto, when Guzman was captured, said it would be unthinkable for him to escape again. And really, I think it completely undermines Nieto's administration. I think it is catastrophic on an epic scale. Mexico is, I covered Colombia when it was in the throes of the drug cartels. And Colombia's success has really exported the problem to Mexico. And now Mexico is facing the same kind of anarchy and the same kind of power struggles between established government and the cartels. And this is a huge setback.
And there's another country, of course, that is going to be as infuriated, if not possibly more infuriated by this, which is the United States. And what was interesting to me was that there was a statement, an absolute masterpiece of understatement from the American Attorney General, who said that the United States sympathized with the authorities in Mexico over the escape, which you rather suggest sympathize was translated as furious, livid. What on earth were the Mexican authorities doing?
It's one of those great diplomatic words, isn't exactly. Do you suspect that she may have had a full and frank exchange of views with her Mexican counterparts?
One does rather feel that.
It's interesting you say that, Mary, because in fact, when I covered Colombia, what the Colombians did in this circumstance, for precisely this reason, is they exported their drug lords to the U.S. to U.S. prisons, and that was how they solved this problem. Because with corruption and technology and the wealth of these guys, the only way to make sure they couldn't that precisely what happened in Mexico didn't happen in Colombia was to send them to some, you know, really harsh American maximum security prison where it's much harder, let's face it, to bribe the guards and to escape.
Well, on that subject,
not that it hasn't happened.
Loretta Lynch, the Attorney General in question, has also said that the United States would be happy to help in locating Mr. Guzman. Again, he is wanted, of course, in the United States on, as you know, whatever charges you can think of.
How many special forces do you think they're going to send?
Well, I don't think we'll ever see him again. I think that he is too smart, and I would be thrilled to be wrong. But you know, he, you know, you talk about the United States. Chicago has declared him public enemy number one. The first time they've done that since Al Capone. I mean, of course, it's all, you know, sort of public stride, and it's strutting. But it really does talk about just how big a deal this guy is. He is supplying hard drugs to America. America has the appetite. Let's be clear. America, you know, as long as there's an appetite, there will be drugs supplied. That is the reality of the drug equation. But this is the guy who's supplying them.
Is there, an argument, Mary, for, and it would obviously undermine Mexico's authority and credibility, of kind of turning this one over to the Americans?
Well, that may indeed be what may happen under the surface. Nobody's going to admit it because, of course, then you end up with, you know, just to link Mexico and Greece for a moment, a colossal diminution of their national sovereignty. So you can't be seen to be, as it were, outsourcing your judiciary and your law enforcement. But you do rather suspect that probably will happen.
I don't know. Colombia did it. And, you know, Colombia, it helped Colombia break the back of the cartels. You know, these guys, they, you know, some of them are sitting in maximum security prisons, and others realize that they better back off.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Miller, and my guests Jeffrey Kaufman and Mary Dejewski. Coming up next, an extension of Islamic State's PR outreach and the diplomatic consequences of an unplanned reception.
It's big, handsome, and we'll spend the whole summer by your side. It's the sun-dappled July-August Quality of Life double issue, and it's waiting for you now. Here's what our editors have lined up.
In the affairs section, we reveal which city tops our annual Quality of Life survey. This year, we have a new number one.
In the business section, many cities have grown organically. Others have a specific blueprint. We look at three of the latter that work.
The July-August issue is on sale now, or make your life easier with a subscription. Visit monocle.com to join the club.
Culture with me, Robert Bound, at half an hour is now shorter, sweeter, new and improved. Where else can you end up informed and entertained after half an hour? By watching a quarter of Oscar-winning The Theory of Everything, by reading the first 20 pages of Kazuo Ishiguro's new novel, by speed-walking through a thousandth of the Venice Biennale, not on your Nelly. Culture with Robert Bound, smaller and even more perfectly formed.
This is what people do for a living, right? They put their shows on. This is the show of shows.
Culture premieres at 1900 hours London time on Mondays.
And you are back with Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Jeffrey Kaufman and Mary Dejewski. Now, obviously, no country is entirely sure how many of its foreign citizens, or how many of its citizens, rather, are fighting with Islamic State's foreign legions. But if Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov is correct, then Russia has provided one of the largest contingents. Lavrov estimates them at 2,000 or so strong. As a cause or effect of this, Islamic State has stepped up its Russian language online outreach with a new outlet called Furat Media. Mary, which region and or demographic of Russia is likely to be most receptive?
Probably. It's going to be the Chechens, and it's going to be people living in the southern Caucasus regions of Russia, people who are already separatist in their sort of philosophy and ideology, who are Muslim for the most part. They are, I think, the group which provides the most of this estimated 2,000 Russians who are fighting or operating with ISIS.
To follow that up, Chechnya's somewhat difficult to love President Ramzan Kadyrov said last month that Chechnya, as he put it, was on the front line of the war against terrorism and is successfully fulfilling its tasks. The Republic has become one of the calmest regions in the Russian Federation. I assure you that this situation will carry on. Is President Kadyrov's optimism justified, do you think?
Well, there's two ways of looking at it. In strictly local terms, he's right in saying that Chechnya is quieter than it's been for a very long time. And there
that's a low bar to hurdle.
Well, there are reasons for this. One of them is that he is ruling it with a rod of iron, and the other is that it's received huge amounts of money from the central government in Moscow. So the combination of those have pacified, to a large degree, Chechnya. But the result is that the fighters and people discontented with Kadyrov have gone over the border just a little bit north of Chechnya into the other southern regions of Russia. And there, they're still busy making trouble, if they're not, as it were, of course, crossing over to fight for ISIS.
Jeffrey, Russia's national security Security Council chief, that is Nikolai Patrushev, has said that there is no possibility of stopping people from the Caucasus who want to go to Syria. Mm-hmm. Is Russia cynical enough to be thinking of Syria and Islamic State as a way of, frankly, getting rid of people that they would rather see the back of?
Well, you know, in a country where you don't hear much truth spoken, I think he's probably being more honest than a lot of people here in the UK and elsewhere in the West. It's really hard to stop these people, and Russia, for all of its FSB fearsomeness, probably doesn't have has much weaker resources for stopping this than Western spooks, but. You know, be careful if you want to foment discord in the end of personal gain, because you never know what will actually result. That's what I would say. And so my answer is I think it's one thing to destabilize, but the extent to which ISIS is really a wild card, I can't imagine that Vladimir Putin and his henchmen really want to see this happening, because we just don't know where it will go. And, you know, we've talked about ISIS, of course, around this table before. But, you know, ISIS is not going away. That's what's worrisome. And as ISIS takes follows the playbook of other insurgent groups, it will and is trying to establish the legitimate features of a state, of government through education, healthcare. It's doing it in a kind of notional way right now, trying to look like it's helping. People are suffering terribly. The question is whether they can actually keep popular support, or else through fear suppress it in perpetuity or in the long term. That's what's not clear. But no, ISIS is a cancer. We know that. I think the Russians know it too.
No, I would absolutely agree, because I think in the back of Putin's mind for so long, I mean, with Chechnya, not just with ISIS, the idea of a threat from Muslim fundamentalism has been in the back of Russia's thinking for a very long time. And this will simply add to it, mm-hmm. Because it suggests that ISIS are just as well organized, as it were, in their outreach to young Russians as they are in their outreach to young Westerners.
It's interesting.
And Putin's not going to be happy about that.
Maybe, you know, finally there's an issue that can actually, the West and Russia can talk about in agreement.
The trouble is that when Putin has talked about it with the West have tended to to divide the problem and say our problem is different from your problem, but here the problem's actually the same.
Well, excitingly, there's a Russo-Western split angle in our final story tonight as well, which is the weekend spectacle of Serbian Prime Minister Aleksandar Vučić being chased away from commemorations of the 1995 Srebrenica massacre. It may not seem important because, after all, maltreatment of foreign dignitaries visiting Bosnia rarely amounts to anything, but the bottles, rocks and shoes that descended upon the Prime Minister as his entourage beat a retreat were a reminder that in a part of the world where some historical wounds remain open for centuries, 2 decades might have been optimistic. Jeffrey, Serbian leaders have visited Srebrenica before. Former President Boris Tadic did in 2010. Was this perhaps unwise for this Prime Minister this year? Vučić, like many Serbian politicians, has a certain amount of form for mid-90s nationalist headbanging, and this is, of course, the week in which Serbia has lobbied Russia to veto a Security Council resolution calling Srebrenica a genocide.
Well, I think you answered it in your intro, as you so often do. but it's, you know, this is actually a very serious topic. Vučić has a terrible, you know, if you look back 20 years, when this genocide was happening, when 8,000 men and boys were slaughtered by the Serbs, Bosnian Serbs were slaughtered, he was very much part of that Serbian nationalism. And he has since distanced himself, embraced the West, tried to look like a modern leader. But as you said, you know, it's clear 20 years is not enough to heal wounds. The families, the children of those slaughtered, of those massacred, are very much alive, and their memories obviously are still very raw. And to see him, you know, in his sort of very solemn state next to Bill Clinton, laying a wreath and saying, "Oh, it's terrible what happened." Clearly, in the eyes of many in that crowd, it's terrible, and you have blood on your hands.
You can sort of understand how it happened, that diplomats all got together and they said, wouldn't it be a good idea, wouldn't it be a terrific symbol of reconciliation if Vučić goes along and he lays his wreath and stands there alongside everybody else? But it's one of these things that works on paper, but you get out there and you discover that the feelings are just as raw, and that this anniversary, the 20th anniversary, is just the occasion when those emotions are going to be right up at the surface. I think it was a completely mad idea.
Is it arguable, Mary, that frankly, for not dissimilar reasons, crimes of omission rather than commission, Bill Clinton was lucky not to have received similar treatment?
Well, I think Clinton is one of those international politicians who manages to, as it were, to sell himself, to pass in every country, every culture that he manages. He manages somehow, he has this knack of reading the public and the context that he's in and behaving accordingly. I first saw him do that when he was a very new president and he went to France. I thought, this sort of really upfront, in-your-face American, it's not going to go down well in France. He was perfect. He behaved, his manners were impeccable. He looked deferential. He did everything right. And I've seen him practically every year in every context since, and he's never lost the knack.
Probably how he got elected in the first place. Final thought on this, Jeffrey. How important is it that Srebrenica be recognised, for what it clearly was, as an act of genocide? And how long is it going to take before the hair splitting over that ceases?
Well, I mean, ask the Armenians and the Turks.
Well,
you know,
fair 100 point.
Years later.
Very fair,
you know,
point.
I think we'll be long gone, and they'll still be debating this one. It's very important. I mean, these kind of wholesale slaughters should be called what they are, and people have to take, if not ownership, they have to accept, you know, the historical realities, and you know, the kind of the effort put into denial does not help us move forward. But ultimately, you know, all of these things, it requires a change of generations. It requires time. But 100 years plus years later, the Armenians still very much, you know, that wound remains very much open. The Turkish denial of the Armenian genocide actually, I think, keeps it alive. So, it is very important to acknowledge it. And, you know, moving on is a bit glib as a term, but yeah.
20 years is simply not long enough.
Indeed not. We will have to leave it there. Jeffrey Kaufman and Mary Dejewski, thank you very much for joining us. That's all we have time for on today's show. It was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Gaia Lutz, Mariana Zuniga, Melkon Çarçoglian, and Paige Reynolds. And our studio manager was Christopher Grimes. Josh Fennett is up next with Monocle's International Playlist. Rob Bound is in at 1900 with The Culture Show. At 2200, I'm back with Dom Reynolds for The Daily. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For this edition, goodbye. Thanks for listening.